you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam, experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Today, it is Wednesday, October 17th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal right now to help end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org to make your donation or join Normal today. We're going to start up our conference giveaways today. You have a chance to get an official Normal 2007 conference poster. It's a big poster, actually. It's about 18 inches tall, maybe a little bit more. It might be about 18 to 24 inches tall. A wonderful piece of artwork by Sonia Rodriguez, who is there signing the posters at the conference. The poster you can win today is signed by Normal's founder, Keith Strupp, as well as the artist Sonia signed this one as well. Just go on up to our website at normalaudiostash.com. You can see a picture of the poster. Send us an email to freestuff@normalaudiostash.com. That's freestuff@normalaudiostash.com. We'll draw a winner and let you know via email if you've won and send out the Normal 2007 conference poster to you. Again, signed by Keith Strupp and the artist who made the poster, Sonia. A wonderful poster for you to hang on the wall and promote marijuana law reform. Today on the podcast, we're going to have some more of the conference audio from Los Angeles last week. Today, we're going to hear Dr. Mitch Earlywine in his presentation, one of his two presentations to the Normal Conference. We'll also hear today Harry Levine. Harry was here on the podcast a few months ago talking about his new data, arrest data from New York City and the racial bias involved with marijuana arrests there. Harry presented this information at the Normal Conference last Friday, and it really was well received, and I heard a lot of people talking about it. So we'll have Dr. Mitch Earlywine and Harry Levine, professor of sociology at Queens College of New York, in their panel presentations today. Also, we get a chance to check in with Dr. Mitch. He's our regular Wednesday guest. Wanted to talk to Mitch a little bit about his experience at the conference. That's coming up first today. On Friday's program, we're going to have Tommy Chong from the Stony Awards, the High Times Normal Stony Awards. That took place last Saturday. We'll also have some music from Joseph Israel and Los Marijuanos. They were the bands at the Stony Awards last Saturday night. Really was a wonderful party, a great show, well attended by a lot of the Normal Conference attendees and local Los Angeles residents, as well as a number of celebrities there at the Stony Awards. Great event there with Normal and High Times Magazine. That's Friday. Tomorrow's podcast will start out with an interview with Wisconsin's Ben Mizell. He's a longtime advocate of hemp and marijuana law reform in Wisconsin, and they're having an interesting event tomorrow night at the Little White Schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin. That was actually the birthplace of the GOP, the Republican Party, back in the 1800s. And it was also one of the places where hemp farming was a center. Wisconsin used to be a center of hemp farming. We'll talk to Ben about that event and also talk to him a little bit about the Harvest Festival, which took place last week in Wisconsin. And in tomorrow's program, we'll have more of our Normal Conference audio as well. Great stuff every day right here on your free stash, Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Make sure you tune in every day and go to our website today. Send us an email to freestuff@normalaudiostash.com. Put free poster in the subject line and you might win a free Normal Conference 2007 poster signed by Normal's founder, Keith Straub. Also real quick here today, I want to give a big happy birthday to the editor of CelebStoner.com, Steve Bloom. It's his birthday today. Happy birthday, Steve. He shares a birthday, well, with many famous celebrity stoners. And also a big birthday shout out to Ben Mizell, who will be right here on the program tomorrow talking about industrial hemp farming in Wisconsin. So happy birthday to you both, Ben and Steve. Let's start off our audio stash today with our short interview today with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Wednesdays here on the Audio Stash, we get to talk about the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. Mitch has another book coming out this winter, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana, and he's got a monthly column in High Times magazine. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Great to be on the show.
Very good to speak with you today, Mitch, and it was just wonderful to meet you in person last week. We're going to play one of your panels on the program today along with Harry Levine. Mitch, let me ask what the conference experience was like for you to be around all of these marijuana reform advocates.
I can't get across how delightful it was, Chris. Part of it is I'm used to going to these scientific conferences where there's a lot more competitiveness and people are really trying to all get the same awards and the same resources. And this was much more, everybody's on the same team. We're all in this together. It was the kind of thing, too, where everybody's so devoted to justice and law and reform. And just, you know, that's going to attract folks with a certain kind of spirit. If, you know, if I had suddenly dropped my wallet or something, I wouldn't have been worried about it. You know, it's that kind of people. And I just really found that an absolute pleasure.
And this panel we'll hear today, it created quite a buzz at the conference, no pun intended there, but this panel with yourself, Marsha Rosenbaum, Harry Levine, Dr. John P. Morgan really had a powerful impact. I heard so many people talking about it.
I was so pleased because you never know how to pitch some of this information and never know how informed people already are, and you don't want to waste anybody's time talking about stuff they already know. I got to hand it to Marsha Rosenbaum, too. Here you got three white male academics, and you're going to try to keep them from going over 15 minutes apiece. That was a real amazing feat, and she pulled it off with real splendid aplomb.
And how about meeting all of these folks who are involved with medical marijuana and dispensaries in California? There were dispensary operators, lawyers, accountants, and on Thursday I actually witnessed the aftermath of a DEA raid on a facility. But it was impressive to see this end of things so up close.
Well, and so much of that is that these are just folks, you know. These are people with kids and lives, and, you know, it's not like cannabis is their everything. And as you start to get to know them and really put faces with the names and also understand that these are real jobs or people who are really suffering and really need this medicine, that human face on it just has a completely different feel from going through statistics or hearing news reports. When you've got a live person right there in front of you, there's just nothing like it.
You know, Mitch, there are also a fair amount of celebrities about at the conference, Tommy Chong, Rick Steves. I have to ask, is that the first time you've run into these folks in particular?
In fact, you know, shaking Tommy Chong's hand was a brand-new thrill. And Rick has helped me in the past, you know, from afar. I took a trip to Prague that a book of his really helped me work through. And I just loved hearing these wonderful parallels about, you know, a love for novelty, a love for travel, a love for meeting new people, of course, is correlated with a love for having novel experiences, a love for perhaps cannabis, but at least a love for letting other folks do what they wish as long as they're not harming others. And boy, that theme was just consistent throughout the whole conference.
And as we mentioned, the medical marijuana community in California was well invested in the Normal Conference. There was a separate sort of semi-private set of panels Sunday afternoon for dispensary operators and experts to address some of the questions surrounding the dispensaries. But also, at the conference, Mitch, there was often expressed this idea that marijuana law reform and the movement needs to continue to focus on legalization overall, not just medical cannabis.
I can't help but agree. I'm really moved by the stories of the medical users and feel like their needs have to be addressed and have to be addressed immediately. Anybody who's suffering needs medicine. We need to get that to them. Nevertheless, for the medical marijuana movement to become the only marijuana movement would really make me cry, because the underlying arguments for medicalizing are certainly important, but the fact that we really want to live in a land that has just laws, where a punishment would fit a crime if it is a crime, that's as important as making sure we, you know, heal the sick, and I want to make sure that kind of stuff doesn't get lost in the midst of all these details about how to open a dispensary and all of that kind of thing.
And let me ask also, Mitch, what was your take home from the conference and perhaps some of the lasting memories?
Well, I have to confess, winning the Lester Grinspoon Award was a peak experience, you know, up there, you know, just behind the birth of my children and my wedding and things like that. It was just so neat to see Keith and Alan so excited for me. But the other thing that really warmed my heart was at the ARO breakfast, Tom O'Connell read an abstract from a paper that will be coming out in Harm Reduction Journal about the medical marijuana users he's seen over the years. And it was just so neat to see somebody from the movement doing this academic thing and reaching out into this, you know, land of data and things along those lines. And it was just such a neat stretch, and he had such a nice grin on his face that it just really, really made me feel good about how there are all these different aspects of the movement, and we all come together and we can all appreciate each other's achievements. There's just nothing like it.
Righto. Well, Mitch, thank you again for joining us here today. We'll be back with our regular cannabis science segments next week, but many thanks for joining us here today, and I look forward to continuing on with our podcast.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. Still in the show today is one of Dr. Earlywine's panel presentations at the Normal Conference last Friday, along with a presentation by sociologist Harry Levine of the City University of New York. Harry's been on the program here before. That is all coming up next. Make sure to send your emails to freestuff@normalaudiostash.com to get your free poster signed by Keith Strupp.
What's up, guys? This is Miss High Times 2007, and you're chilling with us here at the Normal Podcast.
Next up today, we're presenting a portion of the You've Got Questions, We've Got Answers panel at the Normal Conference on Friday. The panel was chaired by Marcia Rosenbaum and included Dr. Mitch Earlywine, Harry Levine, sociologist from City University of New York, Dr. John P. Morgan, professor emeritus of pharmacology at the City University of New York. The panel went through some very interesting data out there, much of which we've discussed with those guests right here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. We're going to play Dr. Earlywine's portion and Harry Levine's portion of the panel today. Dr. Earlywine talks about the myths with marijuana psychosis, much of which come from the UK, and Harry Levine talks about the racial bias in marijuana arrests in New York City. Let's get started with that panel now.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm going to focus on marijuana and mental health. In all honesty, without marijuana, I wouldn't have any mental health. I do want to play up some of the biggest myths we're getting in the media most often. In particular, this idea that marijuana is going to create schizophrenia. I've reviewed this literature, and it's the one I want to spend the most time with you about. Yeah, there might be a subset of people who, if they're really marijuana involved really early in life, they might actually say that they use words in strange and unusual ways. The problem is, that's not schizophrenia. For depression, almost every study has been confounded with either self-medication, people are depressed and they turn to cannabis for relief, or, in fact, they include medical users in their data sets and discover that, what a surprise, people with cancer and AIDS are depressed. Finally, the risk for dependence, which is the one that actually might have some data in support of it, except as soon as you start comparing it with every other drug, particularly tobacco and alcohol, you discover that the risk for dependence is markedly lower for everything except LSD, which, in all honesty, who wakes up and says, God, I'm really jonesing for some acid? So the ONDCP says marijuana can trigger psychoses. There was a huge meta-analysis in The Lancet, except when you start looking closely, there are really only 7 studies in there, and only one of them actually looked at schizophrenia. 6 of the 7 didn't require any impairment. So you could just be kind of a weird dude and still functioning absolutely perfectly, and you would get put in the schizophrenic group. Only 4 of the 7 actually had significant results. 3 of the 7 did not, but nobody mentions that when they're, you know, writing for the UK's Guardian newspaper. Here are all the studies, and what a surprise. They don't look at schizophrenia. They look at schizophreniform disorder, this kind of schizophrenia light, if you will, that's really just, hey, once in a while I do some weird things or have some strange experiences. What a surprise. Pot smokers say yes to that. All the rest of them just basically took any symptom that might be categorized as psychotic and put those folks in the psychotic group. The Swedish data is the one study that had a schizophrenia result. And what a surprise, 6 of the 7 also had absolutely no impairment required. You could be completely functional, paying all your taxes, never in any trouble with the law, and still be in the pathological group. This overall effect size, this 1.41 that's turning into all this big news, if you're an epidemiologist and that number is below 2.0, you usually don't even get to publish your data. But because everybody was so excited about this, sure enough, it happened. Incidentally, a new study just came out showing the link between cigarettes and mental illness, and the risk ratio was 1.61, but we don't have any move to make cigarettes illegal, thank God. Finally, I think Wayne Hall said it best. What if suddenly the risk for schizophrenia went from 0.7 per thousand to 1.4 per thousand? Ooh, we better lock up 800,000 people every year. It just doesn't make any sense. And I find this particularly rough with the move to prevent teen use. I can't tell a teen, hey, don't smoke pot or you're going to go crazy. Every other teen around them is smoking pot and isn't crazy, at least not because of the pot. Right? As I mentioned, these links between cigarettes and mental health are extremely likely comparable to the 1.4 risk ratio we saw before. And the link between cigarettes is actually larger. What a surprise. What's really going on? I think the one study that's any good is this one in New Zealand. Folks who have this special combination of COMT genes, basically, if they used before age 15 or they were a monthly user by age 18, they were often 1.8 to 2.0 and sometimes even more at risk for getting this schizophreniform diagnosis. And they show you the percentages of people who've done each thing and who had each gene. And when I worked it all out, in fact, it turns out they gave you percentages because they didn't want you to see the raw numbers. The raw number in the group with the high-risk gene and the high-risk pot use is 7. 7 people did this and had this happen, and that's what all this is about. I can't say that that justifies 800,000 marijuana-related arrests. The bottom line, yeah, okay, pot's not for kids. If you're under 15, don't smoke pot. If you're under 18, you probably shouldn't smoke pot either. But, again, how many people do we need to throw into jail to make that happen? I'll talk about that a little bit this afternoon. The other thing that blows my mind is what a shitty job they do about controlling for other drug use and how the schizophrenic alleged symptoms are assessed in the first place. Here is one of the items on something called the Schizotypal Personality Questionnaire, which there are 5 studies now suggesting that cannabis users are higher on this. I did an analysis showing that this item is biased. I sometimes use words in unusual ways. Dude, who went for the chronic at 420 and doesn't use words at strange and unusual ways? So what a surprise, people say yes to this item and they're cannabis users, yet that doesn't mean they're psychotic. Once you control for other drug use, my student Nicholas Van Damme has just finished these data. Look, if you don't control for other drug use, yes, it looks like the current cannabis users are markedly more schizotypal. And then as soon as you take the effect of cocaine, heroin, amphetamine, all these other drugs out, what a surprise. The means are exactly the same. Obviously, cannabis is not what's going on with this. The depression data are, let's put it bluntly, depressing. ONDCP says you're more likely to have suicidal thoughts and more depression and depressed in, you know, users. In fact, few of the studies take the medical users out, and again, I want to point out the potential for bias. If in my big data set, I drop the medical users, and suddenly the recreational users are actually less depressed than folks who've never used cannabis. And as one of my critics said, well, they were probably high when they did the questionnaire. Good. The other thing to keep in mind is depression measures are biased against women. In part, it's one of the items is, do you cry? Okay. Hey, butch guys, how much crying you doing lately? Oh, gee, what a surprise. The men don't say that they cry, and it makes the women look more depressed, and the women are also often the ones in the non-using group. So I wanted to just show you these data, and basically the recreational users are significantly lower than the folks who've never used, but the medical users who are usually jammed in with the other folks have higher. Well, what a surprise. You got AIDS and cancer, you're depressed. Finally, just, you know, I did it by use groups. People who used weekly were no more depressed than people who used daily, and they were both less depressed than people who never used. Right. This motivation literature, and I'll stop at this because I promised Dr. Rosenbaum I would actually not go on too long. Some of you have seen the movie Jackie Brown. Ordell and Melanie are talking, and he says, that shit's going to sap your motivation. And she says, what if I'm motivated to get high and watch TV? Kasner's employment data are the most impressive data I've ever seen on this. He correlates cannabis use with taxes paid, wages earned, days of sick leave, medical and health care costs. There are almost always never any relationship except one study where, in men, the more money you made, the more pot you smoked. So if you want to get a raise, fire up your vaporizer. The bottom line is, I'm just going to cut to my sort of take-home message. The dependence rates, these are from the national data sets. Marijuana is less dependence-producing than all of these drugs. And then my student Bob Gore and I just asked 700 mental health professionals to rate dependence risk for all these drugs. Cannabis and caffeine are right about the same. And in truth, I'm a caffeine addict, I got to tell you guys. I need to turn it over to God or something. I mean, just but thank goodness I can actually kick cannabis without getting a headache. All right. Finally, marijuana does not make you mentally ill. However, some crazy people do smoke it. So first and foremost, I'd just like to say, given these data, I really want to make sure that nobody ever goes to jail for owning a plant. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mitch. Our next speaker, I had asked all the speakers to provide a bio, and our next speaker provided 13 pages of bio, and this is in tiny, tiny print because he has done a lot. He's written a lot. He's very smart. Harry Levine, who is a professor of sociology at Queens College in the City University of New York. And he is going to tell us about marijuana arrests in New York City.
For about a couple of years, year and a half, I've been seriously studying marijuana arrests in the United States. I sort of decided that somebody needs to be the world's expert on low-level misdemeanor marijuana possession arrests, the largest variety of drug arrests in the United States or in the world, for that matter. And since nobody else was volunteering for the job, I did. I've been focusing on New York City, but not only New York City, and I'm now sort of moving this to another level. This has not been published any place, although it's been presented in testimony in a couple of places, and it was actually a couple of the graphs I'm going to show you were presented to the United States Senate, not by me, but by a famous economist a couple of weeks ago. This stuff will be available in December in a report, but I really, my next thing I'm going to do is really do national, but I'm going to show you some national data as well. I've been interviewing police, attorneys, prosecutors, some judges, people who've been arrested for possessing marijuana. Again, mostly in New York, but not only in New York. And I've gotten data from the New York State Police Department out of Albany and New York State and FBI data on marijuana arrests around the country. And I want to show you some of what I have found. From 1997 to 2006, New York City Police Department arrested and jailed more than 360,000 people for possessing small amounts of marijuana, 10 times more than in the previous decade and 9 times more than the decade before that. Everybody was charged with a misdemeanor with the lowest level of criminal offense. Everybody was handcuffed, put in the back of a police car, taken to the local police station, fingerprint, photographed, and had their information sent to the FBI, never to come back. Most were then taken to spend the night in one of the city's 5 deplorable and awful scary central jails. These were all cases in which marijuana possession was the most serious offense. In other words, these are not people who were arrested for some other more serious crime and then found to be possessing marijuana. These are marijuana possession arrests. It begins with Rudolph Giuliani. It continues unabated under supposedly more moderate Mayor Michael Bloomberg. They've attracted little attention. The media has barely not talked about this at all. To this day, few New Yorkers know that their city's been on a historically unprecedented marijuana arrest campaign. And the truth is that New York City probably arrests more people than any city in the world right now. Most of the people arrested possessed only a tiny amount, a few grams, and a cigarette, a part of one, or in a $5 or a $10 bag, a nickel bag or dime bag in street parlance. Some people were arrested were just standing with or near other people who were arrested. According to numerous police, public defenders, legal aid, and private attorneys, most of the people arrested were not smoking in public. Let me repeat that. They were not smoking. They simply had marijuana in their possession, often in their pocket. In most cases, the police found the marijuana because they stopped and searched the people in ethically questionable or blatantly illegal searches. Huge numbers of arrests has not been equally distributed among the people of New York. The vast majority of the people arrested have been blacks and Latinos. The arrests of New York have always been racially biased. The huge number increase in the last decade means far more blacks and Latinos are arrested. Of the 362,000 arrests, as you can see here, 54% are blacks, 30% Latinos, 14% whites. In the last 10 years, New York City has arrested 200,000 blacks, 100,000 Latinos, and 50,000 whites. The majority of these people, or a vast majority, are under 30 years of old. 91% are male. Most are poor, working class from the outer boroughs, from cities' less affluent neighborhoods. This shows the arrests for the last 20 years. For the arrests for each year were whites, Hispanics, and blacks. Right-hand column shows the last 10 years. Left is the previous 10. In the last 10 years, although blacks were 27% of New York's population, they're 54% of the arrests, about double. Hispanics were about 27% of the population, 30% of the arrests. Non-Hispanic whites, about 35% of New York City's population, about 14% of the people arrested were white. You can't even see. Here, there's a little bit of a... This is what happens when you go from a Microsoft file to a, those are the whites. You can barely see the lines there. It's supposed to be dark and bold and so on. This gives you the indication for the last 10 years. It allows you to see that disparity has remained quite steady. On average, New York has arrested about 5,000 whites, 10,000 Hispanics, and nearly 20,000 blacks a year for 10 years. It turns out to about 100 whites, 200 Hispanics, or 400 blacks every week for the last 10 years. The greatest discrepancy was in 2006, when 5 black New Yorkers were arrested for every white ones. What about use? Maybe blacks and Latinos use marijuana more than whites, and that's why they're getting arrested. And again, as you can see, those are the white bars stuck over here in the corner. This is a high school senior survey, 2004 and 2005, monitoring the future. The first set of the columns shows the once or more in life, second once or more in the last year, third once or more in the last month, and, of course, the daily use. In every case, whites use marijuana, high school seniors, more than blacks or Latinos. Again, we can't. Those are the white bars. This is 18 to 25-year-old, the household survey. This actually shows 4 years. You get 2002-2003 combined and 2004-2005 combined U.S. government data. Again, in every category, whites are using marijuana more than blacks and Hispanics. This is the age group in New York City and just about every place in America that gets more marijuana arrests than anybody else. These are the people being arrested. This one shows you each of the New York's five boroughs. We have five boroughs or counties. New York is so huge that you can't hide things, or you can't. I mean, if once you can go pull the cover back, it's massive. In each of the five boroughs, it shows the percentage of the population is black and the percentage of the marijuana arrestees who were black. In Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, Staten Island, and in the city as a whole, the black percentage of marijuana arrests was double or more the black percentage of the population. In Staten Island, for example, where blacks were about 10% of the population, they were 50% of the marijuana arrestees. In Manhattan, 17% of the population, about 45% of the arrestees. That continues for all the other boroughs, and you could make a white chart. I have made a white chart that's just the complete reverse of this one. Look at this. We're losing the white people here completely. They're right there. Yeah, it's a kind of subliminal point. This one shows the arrest rate of whites, blacks, and Hispanics calculated by the number of each group in the city as a whole. In 2006, Hispanics were arrested over three times the rate of whites. Blacks were arrested at nearly eight times the rate of whites. This is 2006, the most recent year for which data is available. Here about gender. Here's gender. Men and women. As you can see, men use a little bit more marijuana than women do. This is national figures, but there's no reason. Regional and New York City is pretty much the same. The tall bars are male. The little ones are female. That's kind of my little joke. 91% of the people arrested are male, year after year after year. The New York City Police Department prefers to arrest men, and the jails are designed to hold them. To sum it up here, just this piece, 91% are male, 85% black or Latino, most are 26 and under. New York City is arresting overwhelmingly black and Latino men. Nobody knows what's going on. What about the rest of America? All right, here we have black and white rate of arrests for some major counties in the United States. Going up from the percentage of the population, the black rate of arrests and the white rate of arrests. Atlanta is leading the United States in the rate of black marijuana arrests. Atlanta. New York's in second. Followed, of course, as you can see, by Baltimore, San Antonio. The whites in San Antonio are a distortion because the FBI does not collect statistics information on Latinos. Hispanics are considered not a race, so they're folded into the whites. So some major portion of the whites are actually Latinos. So that's even more racially biased than this appears to be. I have there are about 130, 135 or so counties in the United States with a population larger than 200,000. Just about every single one of them, blacks are getting arrested to 3 to 10 times the rate of whites. Everywhere. Some places, like in California, they give people tickets. Some people, they take them in handcuffs to the police station, hold them for a few hours, and let them go. And in lots of places, they hold them overnight, like in scary, abominable conditions, like in New York City. Everywhere, blacks are getting arrested way more than whites are. Let's go back. This one is just shows the percentage of black population in the county and the percentage of black arrestees in the county. And again, everywhere, blacks are getting arrested at much higher rates than the population. This is Normal's chart. It was all nice. It was two colors in originally. This gives you an idea of what's been happening in the last, since the mid-70s. And it's kind of worth pondering this for a second. Essentially, we get a rise in the early 70s. And by the mid-70s, it hits at about 400,000, and it holds steady for about 20 years. There's a little dip in the late 80s, early 90s, which has to do with the crack cocaine period. The police had their attention diverted temporarily. And then it climbs and climbs and climbs and climbs and climbs. Year after year, it goes higher. I think it's fair to say what's going on in the United States now is a marijuana arrest epidemic. I use that term to describe what's happening in New York. And there's absolutely no reason why it's going to stop unless there's political pressure to do so. Why are the cops doing this? And it's the police that are doing this. And it's mayors that are doing this. But I can't tell you much now. They like it. They like making marijuana arrests. It's easy. They're safe. Nobody's going to get shot or stabbed making marijuana arrests. They are, as one cop put it, clean, meaning physically clean. They're not smelly or dirty. Making marijuana arrests is a quality of life issue for the police. It also allows them, for real, it also allows them to show that they're being productive. Enormous pressure on police departments to maintain and show productivity. How do you show productivity? You go out and make low-level arrests. You find people, you stop them, you search them, you put them up against the wall, you go through their pockets. Most people, the looking for contraband of any kind, the most common form of contraband that somebody's going to have in their pocket is a small amount of marijuana. The police departments don't care about marijuana. They care about their arrest numbers, and they like the marijuana arrests because they're easy. The managers like the arrests. The supervisors like the marijuana arrests. In New York City, cops get overtime for making the marijuana arrests. They make one toward the end of a shift. You get 3 or 4 hours of overtime. In Atlanta, they send brand-new police out to make the marijuana arrests. Why? Because they're not going to get shot. They're not going to get stabbed. They're not likely to shoot somebody. They make lots and lots of collars. They put lots of people in handcuffs. They're racially biased because every major city in the United States, the police focus their efforts on what are called high-crime neighborhoods, which tend to be disproportionately black and Latino. They're searching in only certain areas of the city for certain kinds of suspects. I don't think this is about individual racism on the part of the police. I think this is about orders that cops get to carry out and do what they're told to do. And the result is massively racially biased thing. I think we should talk about this. And I think it's a fabulous thing to talk about. I think that it puts us on the side of the angels, and it can make us terrific allies. Are marijuana arrests racially biased? You bet your ass they are.
That was Dr. Mitch Earlywine and sociologist Harry Levine at the Normal Conference last week in Los Angeles, California, on the You've Got Questions, We've Got Answers panel. That entire panel will be available in video DVDs coming up soon. Stay tuned here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash to find out how you can get those DVDs, and send us your emails today to freestuff@normalaudiostash.com, freestuff@normalaudiostash.com. And you might be the lucky winner of a free Normal Conference poster signed by Normal's founder, Keith Strub. Send in those emails today. We'll be back at 4:20 tomorrow. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.